Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can find out more about what's happening at Fundrise and where you'll hear some in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting the U.S. and global economies. My name is Cardiff Garcia. I'm an economics podcaster and co-founder of Bizarre Audio, and today's episode is being recorded on Friday, July 22nd. Before we get started, we just want to say thanks to everyone who has rated and reviewed the podcast in their apps. We got quite a few of those after the last episode. We really appreciate it. And we'd love for more of you to rate and review the show because we love hearing from listeners. And today I am joined, as always, by Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. Ben, hello.
Hey, Cardiff. Let's do this.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ben, as has now become the custom in the second half of the show, we are going to bring on Kendall Davis, who's the Fundrise head of investor relations and investor operations. And the two of you are going to field some questions from investors and from Onward listeners. But first, very exciting, we are actually introducing a new voice to Onward for the first half of the show. So Ben, why don't you do the honors and tell our listeners who our guest is for this episode?
So I'm really excited to introduce Brandon Jenkins. He is a co-founder of Fundrise. He is chief operating officer. He is one of the smartest people I know. He and I have been working together for more than 10 years. He's led many parts of the organization over time. He's a tremendous individual.
And Ben, you and I are going to be tag teaming as we grill him. I'll be playing sort of the common man, the man on the street, trying to understand what it is that he does. And you'll be coming in with some wonkier and more detailed questions from time to time.
That's my specialty, Cardiff.
Yeah, let's get him on here. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Hey, Cardiff. Excited to be here. I will try and live up to Ben's high praises.
To the hype. Yeah, and Brandon, our topic today is the single family rental market. It's a house rather than an apartment that is rented out. This is a market that's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of investment in the last couple of years. And we are going to discuss Fundrise's approach to it, which I think differs in a crucial way from how other companies approach it. But even before that, why don't we actually just start by defining the trend? What exactly is the single family rental market? And why don't you describe the activity in the sector from the last couple of years?
I'm really excited to talk about it. It's something that has become such a huge part of our business and something that we've been so excited about for so many years. I think it's really useful to understand a little bit of the history of how the space evolved. People have owned and then rented homes for decades. The industry as it exists today, the more institutionalization of the industry, that's really occurred since 2008. So you had a period in 2005, 2006, 2007, of a large volume of building of homes. And then you have the 2008 financial crisis and people are losing their homes. There's tons of foreclosures. And so what happened was the private equity funds, the Wall Street hedge fund, those groups saw an opportunity and start buying huge portfolios of homes from distressed auctions, things like that. And if you look at the groups that were coming in, they're really traders. They trade stocks, they trade other financial instruments. So there was an opportunity to come in, buy those homes, and then turn around and at some point flip them and sell them for a profit. What happened was that they essentially needed something to do with the homes while they owned them, and they needed a way to manage them. And so that kind of spawned the creation of what we would describe as like the institutional single family rental business. So again, you go from years of many individuals who may own a second home who will rent it as part of an investment strategy that they have to big corporations that have tens of thousands of homes and are managing them professionally and renting them the same way that an apartment owner would rent a home. And that really grew from the 2012 period. You see the inception of the big single family rental companies that exist today, Invitation Homes, groups like that.
Yeah. And other than the depressed prices in the wake of the financial crisis, what do you think was the appeal to institutional investors of getting into this market? Because I'd imagine that it's quite a logistical challenge to now oversee a portfolio of individual homes as opposed to buying a typical apartment complex or developing an apartment complex or something like that. Like, is there a development in technology that makes it easier to do this? Why do you think the market took off when it did?
I think there are two aspects to that. Something that I know everyone's heard Ben talk a lot about is the advantages of residential real estate. So rental housing as an asset class have been such a popular investment in the real estate industry for so many years. And I think a lot of people recognize that renting a home was not necessarily that different from renting an apartment. And so it had a lot of the same attributes that apartment rentals have from an investment quality standpoint. And then, as you pointed out, there was a evolution in the technology. So the ability to manage many homes scattered across the country from a centralized operation wasn't possible maybe a decade before. And so that change in technology created an opportunity for an asset class that essentially hadn't existed in that scale up until that point in time.
And you took us into the late 2010s there. And before we talk about how the COVID pandemic might have complicated the story or changed the story, I'd love to start talking about how Fundrise decided to get into this market. As I understand it, it happened a couple of years before COVID struck. So why don't you take us through your and maybe Ben's thinking in terms of the strategy for Fundrise in approaching the single family rental market?
Something I know Ben's talked a lot about is we have this top-down thematic approach to how we think about investing. We think about what are these big macro trends that are happening and how is that going to impact the real estate industry? There were really two big trends that we were focused on at that time. One was a demographics trend. What we'd say is the aging of the population. The millennial generation is going from being in their young 20s, which everyone was living in cities, living in apartments, and that spurred this massive growth in cities at that time. They're getting older. They're thinking about starting families or they're looking for more space. So you had a demographic shift where you were going to see a move from people in smaller apartments to wanting more space, whether that was townhomes or full like detached home with yards. And then the second one is the affordability and the move to the Sun Belt, which, again, I know we talk about plenty on the podcast and something that we cover a lot as we think about our investment strategy. But we saw these two trends coming together where the generation of young people looking for more space and then the growth of the Sun Belt cities and people moving from high cost major metro markets to the Sun Belt. One of the first times we identified this as a trend or something that seemed interesting, we had invested in an apartment building in Austin, Texas. And so we were looking at the performance of the apartment as we were leasing it up. And something that stood out to us was that the ground floor units of the apartment building were seeing a lot more demand. There was a wait list for those units. For us living in DC, that stood out. If you're living in a city, the ground floor unit is the least desirable unit. So we asked the property manager, what's going on here? Why are all these people looking for these units? And they said, well, they have these nice semi-private yards. So it's almost like you get the benefit of a home, but you're still in an apartment building. You get all the other benefits of the amenities. And so that clicked for us, this idea that this demographic, this generation, they're going to be looking for the benefits of an apartment, but really looking for more space. How is that going to play out? What does that product look like? And that began our foray into the single family rental space. So from there, we started to look at who across the country was doing this. And it was a industry that actually had started to grow up specifically in the Phoenix area. There were two developers in that area who had started to build these horizontal multifamily communities, which is just a fancy way of saying it looks like an apartment community, but instead of being four stories, it was a bunch of single story homes. And they were popping up all across the Phoenix market. Hugely popular, again, seeing wait lists of people looking to rent there. So we started working with those developers. We actually began financing the construction for one of those groups. And that led us, again, down this path of there's going to be demand for this product. It doesn't exist anywhere, exists very few places. How do we figure out a way to create this product because there's going to be such a demand from people as they move out of cities?
And by the way, when you started your answer and you noted that Fundrise had a top-down thematic approach, I initially heard fanatic. And I thought, you know what, having spoken to Ben a few times, that makes a certain amount of sense as well. But Ben, I'd love to get your thoughts on this too. So Brandon explained there nicely how you noticed the burgeoning demand in this sector. I'd love to hear more about the actual decision-making process where you finally decided to jump in with both feet around 2018 into this market.
Well, so a few things. One is that there were two builders in Phoenix building horizontal multifamily. We backed one of them. I think he's built 9 or 10 projects, but we wanted to do more of it. And the challenge was twofold, affordability and also sensibility. As much as we love single family rental, we didn't think our investors wanted to have us go compete with them for homes. most institutions buy their homes in the same way individuals do, off of Zillow, off of Redfin. They're competing for the same homes. And we did not think that was a good idea. Our team wouldn't like that. Our customers wouldn't like that. So we said, okay, we know there's a demand for this, but we didn't want to do it the traditional way.
Why would your team have been resistant to that idea of doing it the way that these other places were doing it?
So most major private equity funds in real estate are big institutions. Their investors are institutions as well. Everybody's a professional investor who probably manages billions of dollars. And so they're much more quantitative and they're not focused on the impact they're going to have on communities. We found our individual investors, they want good returns, but they also want to see good results. They don't want to make money and do harm. Our investors are much younger than the average real estate investor. Most real estate investors are 65 years old. They're boomers. Our customer, our investors are mostly Gen X and millennials or even Gen Z. So that younger customer has different ideas about the world. And so we knew that if we were going to go in to capture this macro trend we believed in, we had to do it a different way that would fit what they're looking for.
And then, Brandon, as you and Ben are coming up with the specific Fundrise strategy that differs from the way that other places were doing it, can you just talk about how you developed that strategy and what you sort of arrived at and all the different competing variables that you considered in coming up with it?
We do something that we call build to rent. It's now part of the single family rental space specifically. At the time, the idea of build for rent didn't really exist. Build for rent means we're not buying homes that already exist. We're actually constructing brand new homes that are purpose-built, specifically designed for a renter. And we build them really as communities. So if you think, again, like an apartment community has amenities, you might have a gym, you might have walking trails, dog park, things like that. Our idea was design communities that are communities of single-family homes that are specifically designed for renters. That didn't really exist. There was no place to go make that investment. So the question became, okay, how do we create this asset class?
You're adding new supply, in other words. I mean, one of the big macro themes of the last, frankly, 15 years has been that there are parts of the country with severe shortages of housing supply. You're adding supply and in the rental space, not in the homeowner space, right?
Exactly. We haven't built enough homes in the U.S. for the number of people who want homes. The numbers people talk about now is anywhere from high threes to 5 million homes short. So essentially, there's 4 million more people who would like to live in homes than we have homes available. And that undersupply of housing is causing all sorts of challenges and problems. It's chronic to the country at the moment. And so creating supply became an inherent challenge to executing the strategy.
Yeah, I have a good example. So this was 2019, before we figured out how to scale, but we bought a property outside Washington, D.C., and it was a parking lot for FedEx Field. And there was also an old strip center basically failing. And then people were trying to turn it into more apartments, and typical apartments in the suburbs are walk up a few stories tall. We looked at it and it said, what people want are homes, not just apartments. I mean, there's nobody in Washington, D.C. building homes to rent. And so we went to Prince George's County and we said, we want to do this. And they said, we've never heard of anybody asking us to do that. And we've done this a few places where you go to Nashville, you go to Atlanta, and you ask them basically, you zoned it for apartments, but we want to build houses for rent. And it was just a completely novel idea because it's not housing for sale and it's not apartments to rent. It was something in between. And they didn't even have a zoning designation for it. So that's how new it was when we started now 3 or 4 years ago. And it's becoming this incredible sort of new asset class. And I think that's why we're going to see good returns from it, is that it created a new product type that people want.
Yeah. One other thought that provokes is that you seem to be combining elements of what traditionally might have been thought of as like urban living, right? Renting, walkable amenities, with what traditionally would have been thought of as suburban living or ex-urban living, you know, space, an actual home, not an apartment. And I'm wondering if that was something that you did consciously or if that was just the sort of inevitable byproduct of trying to develop this asset class.
It's a great observation. It was explicitly intentional. We were looking at this customer, this demographic, and in a lot of ways, it was pretty easy because we're looking at our team. That person who was living in a studio or one-bedroom apartment, they had gotten accustomed to all the aspects of urban living that you just described, but they had outgrown the space. So achieving something that really gave them the benefits of both worlds was something that we believe was going to basically be a huge demand.
I'm curious to know, what were some of the other logistical or mechanical or other challenges to entering this space anew? Because all of it was at least a little bit novel. I mean, as Ben described, you're creating a new asset class here. So can you talk about what some of the obstacles are that you've come across in the last few years?
So when we first reached out to some of the builders, there was hesitation on their part. They were afraid that selling homes to renters was going to bring down the value of the home product that they were building. There's a stigma around having rental homes within existing for sale home communities that the renters are going to not take as good care of their homes. They're going to depress the value for the homeowners. So it went from we're hesitant about this to we're open to it in limited ways to actually, we see having the renters as like an asset at this point. Because you have professional management, those homes are generally the most well upkept. Now the relationships we have with the builders is much more of a partnership, whereas they look at building new communities. They're reaching out to us early in that process and essentially saying, let's talk about how we can have a portion of this dedicated for rental.
One of the reasons we can drive the rents down and get affordable rental properties built is by building hundreds or thousands of homes. And one of the reasons we work with home builders is they have the operations down to the level of efficiency, and you purpose built for rental. So there's all sorts of things you're doing differently. And there's a win-win because the home builder looks at a site and says, I can only absorb 300 homes in this area, but I could build 500 if you guys would purchase 200 of them.
Let's get up to speed then. How has it gone so far? At least take us through until, let's say, the end of last year, early this year, when certainly mortgage rates started to shoot up. How did it go in those first few years and into the first year of the pandemic?
The short answer is it's been very successful. When we started investing into the space, this was pre-pandemic. Again, there were a lot of big drivers that we felt like were going to be huge tailwinds for the space. The pandemic occurred and two things happened. Home buyers disappeared. So overnight, the builders were extremely eager to be working with us because they had all these homes that were in production and there was no one to sell them to. And so the first thing that happened, we became the best friends and best buyer that they had. The second thing that happened, which we didn't expect it at the time, but you had this movement out of cities. So all these people, young people, were leaving the major metro markets. Ben's talked about before, we had people on our team all in DC, and they scattered across the country. They moved to Charlotte, they moved to Dallas, they moved to Austin, Atlanta. Acceleration is the best way to describe it. An acceleration of these macro trends drove many, many, many more young people to these markets that we're investing in. You have people moving to these areas for affordability. They're moving to get space, to have a yard, to get outside. And then all of a sudden, I'm working from home. I can't work from home in a one-bedroom apartment that I'm sharing with someone else. I need space. So the single-family home as a rental product became this ideal consumer experience for the person who wanted more space, was looking for affordability, and then really needed a place to work. And so we went from being very excited about it to seeing just a massive demand that drove the returns that we saw over the last year on the platform being so, so, so strong. And to the point where we're at today, where we really are as excited about this asset class as anything else that we're investing in at the moment.
And then starting last year, but really, really accelerating this year, the Fed obviously has been raising rates and mortgage rates have really spiked. And I'm wondering if now what's happening is that home buying has become unaffordable for a lot of people who were maybe optimistic until last year about buying a home. And so whether that's going to lead to at least resilient demand for single family rentals and for your products in particular, because it is a little bit more resistant to rising mortgage rates. If anything, it might even be sending some folks to you, to single family renters, and away from buying.
Before we saw this big spike in mortgages, the communities that we had completed, so we've fully built out communities, we were seeing wait lists of people who wanted to live there. And then rents growing double digits year over year. And that was in advance of the spike in mortgage rates we've seen. The other thing that Ben's talked about before is of the people who were leaving the communities, like 70% of them said that the reason they were leaving was to actually buy a home. And so we had all this demand already for the product. And then you look at how mortgage rates have grown, as you said, the same house is all of a sudden 20% more expensive. That's going to make it much more difficult for a lot of people to afford that home. That person who is looking to buy, again, still wants the benefit of the home. They're looking for a home to live in, whether they need space, they have a family. But as mortgage rates have risen, that's made it that much more expensive to buy a home. That is only increasing the demand for our houses. And it's something that we've seen in the performance as other assets are struggling. The demand for our rental homes has remained remarkably resilient through this time period.
Can you position Fundrise within the larger real estate industry here? Like, how big is the Fundrise involvement in this market relative to its overall size, and give us like that sense of scale?
So today, our build-to-rent platform, we own a little over 3,000 homes, and we have several thousand more that are under construction with our builder partners that we'll close on over the next 12 to 24 months. At that scale, I'm going to say 5,000 purpose-built, build-to-rent communities and homes. That's up there with probably some of the largest build-to-rent specific operators in the country. That gives you a sense of how quickly we've scaled the platform. And then on the internal side, we have a team of close to 20 people at this point who have come from different parts of the industry and really just specialize exclusively in operating the platform that we have. And the benefit that we have at Fundrise is we're a technology company in addition to being a finance company, in addition to being a real estate investor. And so as we've built out the platform, we have a team of engineers who've been building software systems that our team uses, which are really exclusive both to Fundrise, but also to the build-to-rent industry, because it's a space that's still essentially evolving. And so a lot of the processes we're creating, we're having to really build them from scratch. And so the benefit of being able to do that with the software component that we can build in-house is, I think it's been key to the growth and acceleration that we've had in the platform so far.
I have a delicate question here, and I'd love to hear from both you, Brandon, and from Ben on this. Not everybody loves the idea of institutional investors getting more and more involved in the housing market. For one thing, I don't think people like the headlines or the idea that Wall Street is going to be your new landlord. And I think there's a perception that it also contributes to the unaffordability crisis in housing. And I'd love to just get your responses to those criticisms.
It's a great question, and it's something we think a lot about. As Ben said, as we thought about how to invest in this space, we had an understanding of what we thought was going to be important to our investors. So I like to separate that question into two parts. One around what I'll say is the affordability of housing. And then the second, I really think of it as the idea of housing as the American dream, that owning a home is this essential part of the American dream. So from an affordability standpoint, we talked about it a little bit, but I think people are starting to understand that so much of the affordability challenges that exist in housing in the country are really driven by this dramatic undersupply. If you look at the number of homes that have been built over the last decade compared to decades before, there's just been so many fewer homes being built. And so much of that is because of what happened in 2008 with home builders going out of business. And the number of homes being built since that time period has just dramatically lagged the need. And so you look at the country being short 4 million homes, and the price of homes as a result has just grown so much faster than incomes. I think if you look back from 1960 to today, incomes have grown something like 30%. Home prices have grown something like 120%, and that's on average. If you look at specific markets, home prices have grown 200%. So many of the affordability challenges stem from this chronic undersupply of housing. But if you look at the single family rental space as a percentage of total homes, it's something like 10 or 11%. And it's actually fallen over the last 7 years or so. So it's understandable to me when you see a hedge fund bidding with five families on a home that's on the market, why that's going to create some of that. But if you really want to look at what is driving the affordability challenges and the issues that are actually kind of underlying it, it's much, much deeper than that. focusing just on the single family rental space is kind of a surface level analysis that doesn't actually get at the root of the problem.
You had started talking about the idea of the American dream. What did you mean by that?
Right. So I think some of the criticism that you see is the idea that the growth of the single family rental industry is inherently a negative thing. When I say it comes from this idea of the American dream, thinking about that and breaking it apart, what is it that someone's getting when they own a home? I think mostly what people are looking for is actually the home as a product. They want the space. They want to be able to grow a family. They want a yard. They want to live in a good school district. They want to live close to good amenities. So the home as a consumer product, I think, is critical. But the build-to-rent product that we build, I would say, delivers that consumer product to the individual. And in a lot of instances, in a way that some of our renters are actually more excited about, the idea that you have to own your home to get the benefit of a home seems a little bit outdated to me. There are a lot of our renters who we would say are rent by choice renters. They want all the benefits of a house, but they don't actually want to own it. They don't want the headache of dealing with home ownership. They actually like having a management company like you would at an apartment take care of the broken water heater or replacing an HVAC unit or something like that. And then there are people who just, they're not ready to buy. It gives you more flexibility in terms of moving. So there's so many different areas where as consumers, we've changed from having to own everything. People don't want to own cars anymore. At this point, you don't own your phone. You actually are renting your phone, clothing subscriptions, food subscriptions. The idea that you have to own the home to get the benefit of the home, that to me is something that it just isn't true. The second part of the American dream idea is that the home is an investment. You know, over the last several generations, owning home is the single best investment you can make. And I think that's where obviously Fundrise comes in very specifically and says, no, you could rent a Fundrise home within one of our communities and be invested in Fundrise and get the exact benefits of home ownership through the Fundrise platform. You could actually get it arguably at a much lower cost, and you could actually be diversified across 5,000 homes, which maybe if from an investment standpoint is a safer investment than being all your eggs in one basket. So what we've provided here essentially is a way for someone who couldn't afford to buy a home to actually get both of those benefits.
Yeah, and to position this in macroeconomic terms, we also know that the dynamism of the U.S. labor market had been falling for decades leading up to the COVID pandemic and home ownership, which I want to be clear, like no shade at people who prefer to own homes. That's still 2/3, I think, of American adults live in owned homes, but it can be, home ownership can be a hindrance to labor market dynamism because it does make it harder to move to where the jobs are if that's something that you do want to do. So I thought that was a really interesting point. Ben, accusations of villainy. What say you?
Oh, it must mean we're very profitable. We knew like early on that because we are a consumer brand, we have a million customers, we had a good sense that they didn't want us buying homes in competition with them. So we went out to build homes. So the single family rental industry is very contrasted from the build to rent. It's a totally different industry. Build to rent, small. I think there's 16 million single family homes that are rented nationwide. I think something like 300,000 are owned by the single family rental industry. And build to rent's only like, you know, less than 50,000. Those numbers help you get a context of what's happening. And then I wanted to add a couple other small points here. One is that the sort of the chronic undersupply of housing is because home building is risky. Why is home building risky? Because home buying can stop on a dime. And it stopped on a dime in March 2020 and is stopping again. And so if you have a home and you've built it, you can't sell it, you have a big problem because it's binary. It's either sold or it's not sold. And so the home builders, the only way to manage that risk has been to undersupply the market. And so what's been happening over the last 10 years is chronic, consistent undersupply to manage their own risk. And so what we believe is that build for rent is the sort of risk mitigator for the industry. We will buy consistently under contract. We'll go under contract 1, 2, 3, even 5 years before delivery, which takes the risk off of the shoulders of the home builder. It's so fundamentally different from a home. You literally, you deliver it normally and sell it on that next Saturday. So they have a very, very, very short timeline ordinarily, but a very long life cycle to deliver that home to a home buyer. Any new home you're buying today has been on the books in the pipeline of a home builder for years, 3 years, 5 years. It takes a long time to entitle the properties, get all the horizontal construction in, and then get the actual home built. So this disconnect between risk and undersupply has been, I think, a fundamental flaw of the market.
That's really interesting. And something I hadn't really considered before is that it's easy to understand how demand for single-family rental could be a little bit more resilient to a downturn because it'll send some people who can no longer afford housing to buy, it'll send them to rentals. I hadn't considered the idea that because it's a little bit less riskier to build, that the supply side response to that demand will also be a little faster and a little bit more elastic, I guess. Is that more or less what you're saying here, Ben, in economic terms?
Yeah, but it's not a little bit less risky. It's a lot less.
Okay.
I mean, if you look at the lenders to apartment builders, apartment owners in 2008, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, who are big lenders to apartment buildings, the default rate, I think, for Freddie Mac was 0.2% or something at the worst of times, 2008. I mean, just absolutely minuscule. And to the home buyer, Bank of America and JP Morgan and Wells Fargo were literally foreclosing on 6-7 million homes. So there's just this massive difference in risk profile. It's probably 100x less risky. And so it really is transformative for the home builder who's previously was taking all this risk on a binary market, on a binary buyer.
To close things out before we bring in Kendall, who I understand has some really intense investor questions, and she's just going to lob some bombs at you guys. I can't wait to watch that. One final question for both of you, Brandon and Ben. What is one thing that has surprised you since you got into the single-family rental space, something that you've learned about that particular market?
I've been surprised how diverse the renters we have are in the communities that we own. We had come at it from a standpoint of the 30-year-old who was about to start a family was moving out of their apartment and looking for a home. As we've built these communities, it's been really interesting to me to see just the broad range. Young people who really just want more space, older families who are downsizing, it's made me that much more bullish on the space because I think there's actually that much more growth that's going to come into this industry over the next really several decades.
Yeah, Ben?
I always love these curveball questions, Cardiff. So the thing that surprised me the most, and I think something we will start to talk about more in the next probably like few months, is once we Fundrise got directly at the asset, and so we get now to apply technology like at the real estate. When we were working with real estate companies, you can't apply technology. It's like that substance does not conduct electricity. You can't conduct electricity through rubber. And that's what a real estate company is to technology. They're just anti-tech. And now that we have the assets, we have the databases, we have the customers, we have an entire engineering team working on this, there's a lot more innovation in this space than anywhere else in real estate. We're building a specialized technology platform I think is going to be really interesting. It's one of the reasons why I think our performance has been strong and has a lot of potential to perform in the future. So the technology aspect of single family rental, it's why it got unlocked in the first place from an institutional point of view. But also it's like early days and all the types of things we can do and are doing. So that's been really fun and exciting.
Excellent. Well, if you thought that was a curveball, wait to hear what Kendall's got in store for you. So I think it is time to bring on Kendall Davis, head of investor relations and investor operations at Fundrise, who's been waiting patiently with her bazooka full of investor questions for Ben and for Brandon. So Kendall, the reins are yours.
Oh, thank you. I can't take any credit for these questions. They come straight from the mouth of our investors. So I won't apologize for bringing the high heat today, but we're really starting to get some great questions from our investors, given what's going on in the macroeconomic environment about valuations, institutional investment in the single family space, as we touched on a little bit, And of course, more questions on our innovation fund and what the hell a real estate company is doing investing in growth equity. So I'm pumped to dive in. So we'll start easy. I think this one actually ties in really well with the conversation Ben and Brandon, you guys were just having with Cardiff. So we had Jeff from Ohio who wrote in specifically saying, does Fundrise have a view, opinion, or insight on the phenomenon I've been reading about that first-time homebuyers are having a hard time buying a house because investors, including Fundrise, I assume, are buying them with cash offers? So this is a little bit of a spin on some of the questions you were answering earlier. He's specifically talking about first-time homebuyers and cash offers. What do you say?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question because I kept wanting to interrupt Brandon to say, like, we're not defending institutional ownership of single family rental. Like, we're not doing that. That's not what we do. We have concerns about that. And because we end up owning 100 homes in a community that we built for rent, we get grouped into it. And it's just totally different business. We don't buy homes from home sellers. Like, if you're a normal single family rental company or a normal home buyer, we'll buy a home they see on Zillow or on Redfin, and the seller is an individual who used to live in that home, who wants to sell it. We don't do that. We don't buy homes from individuals. We only buy homes that we are building or were built with home builders and developers. We're not competing with home buyers for all the reasons we've said and then some. But we did recognize that it was going to be a great investment strategy. So we had to create a unique way to get at it. And that's what we ended up doing with Build for Rent. And we ended up, I think it's going to be better because it's not scattered. It's concentrated. We have operating benefits. We have like amenity benefits. We own 100 homes in a community, so we could later come back and convert one of those homes to a cafe. We could turn it into a WeWork cafe, so we add more amenities. We own the land. We could add backyard ADUs or backyard accessory dwelling units. There's a lot of potential for it that's distinct. So anyways, I'm also concerned about that movement where we worked hard to try to differentiate ourselves from it. We haven't done the best of jobs showing, explaining how what we're doing is nothing like the institutional single-family rental space.
I love that you just say right off the bat, like, we're not defending institutions. And that's something that I think we're constantly drilling in and is part of the DNA of Fundrise is like, we're so anti-institutions in many ways. And
yes.
So that's what scares me about our own growth is we're like constantly trying to bat off any sort of sign of us becoming too institutional.
The founding team's still here and we are anti-institutional. That is for sure. I'm a deep skeptic of institutions.
If anyone hasn't listened to Ben's podcast earlier talking about VCs and the private equity industry, you can go back and see just how he feels about the typical establishment. All right, so we're going to turn up the heat a little bit. So we've got question two from Larry from Florida. Larry had a really in-depth conversation with one of our team members and had some really good questions. He said, a lot of the public REITs are down 30 to 40%. Simon Property Group is down from around $200 to $100. I'm not seeing that in any sort of mark-to-market, your flagship fund. How do I do any sort of due diligence to think that the price that I'm getting on the flagship fund is a fair price when real estate is getting crushed in the public markets? It's a good question.
Yes, definitely a skeptical question. Okay, so I think about breaking that up into two parts. So one is about the public markets and public REITs and what that pricing is and how it makes sense. And the separate is, what does our pricing look like and what's going on with our portfolio? So let me just do public REITs first. I'm super familiar with Simon Property Group, done deals with them, and in prior life built malls. And so I'm not a big fan of owning malls, and our residential Sun Belt couldn't be any more different than owning malls across the United States. So it's not a surprise to me that Simon Property Group's down so much. I would put that aside and say, okay, but what's happening with other types of public REITs that are more comparable? And there are a couple that we like and track and have owned in our portfolio. Flagship Fund has owned some liquid stocks and bonds. And we at one point owned Mid-America Apartments, which is the biggest owner of Class B apartments in the Sun Belt. And we've also owned Invitation Homes, which is the biggest owner of single family rental. And we sold them both earlier this year because we felt like the stock market was going to collapse. And it did. Our strategy is not like those strategies, right? So they're not a perfect proxy, but they both declined about 20%. And you saw some of these good companies decline 20%. And our portfolio is on average up about 5% through this half of the year. So they're down 20, we're up 5%. Why? So getting to the math of it, because I had this question actually on Reddit. So I went out and did a little basic back of the envelope. And if you go look at Invitation Homes, their cap rate, which essentially is how real estate price to earnings, was 3.5% approximately June of last year. And the stock price has fallen. Now it's 4.2%. I'm talking in very technical terms for real estate folks. But last year, the price of that stock was basically too high at 3.5%. And so it's fallen a lot, but it's actually come much more down to where it ought to be, which is around mid to low fours. And the same thing happened with Mid-America. It was priced at around a 3.8 or 3.9 cap rate, and the price has fallen. Now it's a 4.5 cap rate. So for those who are really technical, I wanted to give you those details because you can hear those numbers and say, okay, well, those numbers are about where private market deals are being done. The public markets was pricing at a premium. It was more expensive to buy public stocks than it was to buy the same apartment building in the private markets. And now it's trading much more in line. They're different strategies than what we pursue, but the pricing is much more in line between public and private. And the question is it going to fall some more? I think it will fall some more. And if it does, we've been building up cash reserves, and we would, no question, deploy into public markets if there was a great premium of public stocks over private assets. And that's one of the things of having these crossover funds. Very few funds can live in both worlds, private and public. I believe the private-public distinction is overblown. It's a regulatory distinction, and the market shouldn't price too differently between the two depending on the assets. So anyways, that's sort of an answer of like, why did public markets fall so much and Fundrise hasn't? It's because they had a pandemic spike that they gave back at the beginning of this quarter. And the second part is, what's driving our performance? Interest rates are a lot higher. Cap rates are rising. How come your asset values aren't falling? And the essence of that is because of rent growth. Our rent growth is growing on average approximately 8%, sometimes a little more, 10%, sometimes in the teens. And so interest rates grew from 2 to 3% to 4 to 5% in real estate. So our rent growth is pricing at a huge premium over interest rates. Let's say 8% rent growth, 4 or 5% interest rates, that's a 3 or 4% premium. And normally, it's the opposite. In normal times, you might be borrowing at a 3 or 4% interest rate, and rent growth is usually 3%. So rent growth is usually lower than interest rates. And you have rent growth or CPI of 3%, and you have cash flow, and that's usually your total return. But when you have this sort of unusual situation where interest rates are actually lower than inflation by a lot, that's driving value. And something I've experienced in my career is that interest rates and cap rates, they change with the wind. Sometimes they're high, sometimes they're low. Just because they're raising now doesn't mean they won't fall 2 or 3 years from now. But rent growth, usually rent growth is more permanent. So if rent growth goes up, you rarely give it back. Like in the depth of the 2008 financial crisis, rents went down 1% to 3%. And so you didn't really give back much in that crisis. And that crisis, I think, was a real estate crisis. It was a crisis driven by deflation and oversupply. And this crisis right now is inflation and undersupply. So it seems really unlikely that you're going to see the kinds of dynamics you saw in the last crisis in real estate this time. So there's just these huge lift that's driving real estate. And just adding one more point that's distinct is that our real estate are also value-add strategies. We're out there doing a lot of work, creating value. We're building housing, we're leasing housing. And so that is popping NAV as well. We're not just buying stabilized cash flow property like public REITs are. And so that value-add, like when you build and you lease up and you improve something, it usually creates a net asset value pop or increase in value. So there's a lot of things driving it, but I think we've done well for good reasons. And the next phase of our growth going into next year is going to depend on, are they going to tame inflation, or are we going to continue to have inflation and have rising interest rates? If interest rates get to 8% and inflation is 8%, that's going to be not very good for real estate. I think that there'll be a recession long before that, and that will prevent interest rates from getting that high, and we end up normalizing. But it's going to take a couple of years probably for that to happen. Yeah, there's a lot there. I know.
There's a lot there. It's awesome. I want to like reiterate and also add a little more detail on that value creation component. We're in a heavy stage of lease up. So we're buying vacant homes or homes that are in the construction stage and then leasing them up versus the Invitation Homes of the world. So they don't have that value creation that we do. And I think that is such a huge component of this that people very often overlook. And there might be some variability in the portfolio as we go through acquiring, you know, we're acquiring a lot of homes too, right? And so that does create a lot of value creation month over month as we progress through that lease-up stage. Okay, so let's shift. We've got one last question. And I am excited for this one, Ben, because I think this is another really thoughtful question from someone who has been a big fan of our real estate business that we've built over the last decade and is wondering why the hell we're trying to go into something else that isn't real estate. And we've gotten several of these questions, so I just chose one, and I think he aptly worded it. So I'll read through the question from Michael from California. He says, for Ben and the Fundrise executive team, I've invested quite significantly in Fundrise to date based on not only the performance of the assets, but because of the trust and belief that has been built in your investment philosophies. So I have to say I'm a little troubled by the recent announcement of your innovation fund. While I understand the broader aperture with which you're viewing Fundrise as a technology disruptor, to me, it feels like a distraction from your core business. Frankly, this makes me nervous. You'll lose focus on the real estate fortress in favor of promising, yet ultimately, highly speculative businesses. To be direct, I've invested in your real estate acumen and not necessarily the technology that facilitates the access to your expertise. Obviously, I'm just one investor, and you've made a strong case for pursuing the fund, but I would be remiss if I didn't share this counterview with you.
That's one of the hard-hitting questions you promised here. So yeah, we announced that we're going to start another department or division of Fundrise to invest in private tech. And a lot of our core real estate investors have been with us for a long time. We're skeptical because it looks like a big departure from where we've been. Often say real estate is an anti-tech business, right? It's a value business, not a growth business, except for during periods of high inflation. So there's a shared mindset that investor has with us, which is a mindset of skepticism. Our saying is only the paranoid survive, and we chant that at the morning meetings. I love a healthy dose of paranoia. So the few ways I would think about answering that is about the size or scale of the tech fund, the timing of it, and then the crossover benefits. So first, Fundrise owns about $7 billion of real estate. We have a 100-person real estate and accounting team out of 300 people. The other 200 people are largely engineers and product people. So the team today is clearly focused on real estate. From a scale perspective, the tech fund is likely to be initially 1% compared to the size of the real estate. It's really going to be small. Has a dedicated sort of SWAT team looking at it. It's not operationalized like the real estate team. So from a resource point of view, just doesn't have any possibility of diverting our attention. Second is that Fundrise as a culture is the tortoise, not the hare. It took us 10 years to build Fundrise to date. We always go about things very slowly, very deliberately. And so we're starting with tech slowly, and it's going to happen incrementally. We're not going to just go headlong into it. It is high risk. There's a saying in real estate and tech where in real estate, you make 99 investments and lose all your money on the 100th. And in tech, you make 99 investments and you lose all your money on 99 and you make all your money back on the 100th. So it's like the opposite. One of the reasons I'm really interested in it is that you say that, and you're right, that a lot of our emphasis over the last few years on tech has been on democratizing access. It's been technology to automated fund management and created this sort of very low marginal cost so we could bring it to a $10 minimum and anybody could invest. But behind the scenes over the last year or so, we've been also investing in the real estate operations and the real estate management. And that technology is not ready for public consumption. It'll be another 6-12 months before we'd be able to unveil it. But it's the underneath, it's the guts that's allowing us to do single family rental. We're bringing it into multifamily. And the reason we're investing so much time and effort into technology for our real estate platform is we think it's going to drive huge performance benefits. And there's really nothing like it out there in the real estate industry. So the crossover benefits from investing into machine learning companies, into data infrastructure, really just enriches our understanding of how to bring more technology to real estate. So I don't see it as a distraction. I recognize that's a risk, but I feel like our investors will benefit from it.
Yeah, I love the last part that you were hitting on as it being sort of like a synergistic next step that's good for the company as a whole. In one of the past podcasts, you were hitting on, Ben, how you like to learn new things. And I think that's very much embedded in our culture and why we embrace technology so much. I actually had a call earlier this week where there was another company that wanted to know our secrets. And this happens a lot more than you would guess. It's people are like, tell me your secrets. Can you white label everything that you guys have built? I see that you guys seem to make this look easy. And I was like, look, I hate to bring it to you. I've worked at this company for 8 years. This has been brick by brick. Like, this is not an overnight moment that we had all of the technology and the processes and everything that we have today that makes Fundrise run so smoothly on the real estate side. The great news is that we don't have to recreate the wheel now. We can leverage some of that work that we've done, but it's just been a decade of iterating over time. And I think it's fair to just own that and say, this will take some time too. So thank you, Ben.
Oh, Kendall, I love when you bring the heat and more investor questions. We learn a lot and we definitely want to address the hardest questions we can find.
Bring them on. contact@fundrise.com. Thanks, guys.
And that is it for this episode of Onward, the Fundrise podcast, featuring Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise, Brandon Jenkins, COO, and Kendall Davis, Head of Investor Relations and Investor Operations. My name is Cardiff Garcia of Bizarre Audio. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you like what you heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. This podcast was produced by Seaplane Armada, who also did our music. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next episode.